Hello and welcome back to another episode of the HRER podcast, where we delve into the world of HR emergencies and scandals. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to HRER on your favourite podcast platform.
Get ready for scandalous stories, lessons learned, and a generous dose of advice for HR professionals for navigating the HR landscape.
Our goal here is not just to entertain, but also to help you learn from the topics we touch on in order to save your business from its own emergency.
Simon Anderson.
Barrister specialising in complex employers' liability and occupational disease. He represents folk who've suffered serious physical and psychological harm in the workplace, and you are a serial winner.
I don't think anybody is properly trained in how to manage occupational stress. I just don't think it's in anybody's toolbox. I can also tell you where employers go wrong when faced with that sick note that says stress at work, or the employer who is saying, no, I'm struggling. And it is to tut and roll their eyes. You get that sick note and tut and roll your eyes, and we're going to meet.
Just before we start, protect your business from the risk of tribunal, reduce legal costs, and save yourself from HR headaches with our Hero software and employment law consultancy services.
Back with the guest series. That's what we're calling it, isn't it? It's a guest series.
It's a guest series, yeah.
Yeah, we've got Simon Anderson, who is... I've purposely not dug too much into your past so I can ask you actually engaging questions.
Yeah. Get realistic, you know? Reactions.
Yeah. I'm not like faking it, you know.
Though now we know all about your dinner and TV habits because we were chatting before we started. Yeah. You know, what else is there to know, really?
You're getting your first TV this year by sounds of it, which sounds exhilarating, mate. So
big event.
I'm vying for you for that.
I reckon we read the bio and then we let Simon tell us what we've got right, what we've got wrong, and what you actually do. So
okay.
We've got barrister specialising in complex employers' liability and occupational disease at Park Square Barristers. He represents folk who've suffered serious physical and psychological harm in the workplace, and you are a serial winner.
Yes.
I think serial we all like
winner. That. Yeah. Serial winner. I put that on my bio simply because a lot of the work I accept is on conditional fee agreement terms. No win, no fee, as you may know, which means that if I lose, I'm not paid for my labours. And you can probably think of very few jobs where that happens. Certainly, if I say that to a professional sports person, they'll laugh.
Yeah, definitely.
It depends on your team.
It does depend on your team.
How many people can we alienate in one sentence? Man United, maybe?
Yeah.
I get thrown off my board for saying that.
Big fans, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, yeah, serial winner, because frankly, if I don't win, I'm not paid for my labours.
And that's unusual for a barrister, isn't it? We see it quite a lot with solicitors. Solicitors, well, there's a lot of firms that will build entire practices based on no win, no fee. So
it's not unusual for a personal injury barrister, but it's unusual in that quite few specialise entirely in claimant work. Not everybody has their appetite for risk. And in my particular case, I have that appetite simply because I understand what I do.
Yeah.
And once you have that deep knowledge and understanding and appreciation of what you do, you can calibrate the risk. And once you understand the risk, you understand that actually it's not as perhaps risky as others might perceive it to be.
It rings true in my head from like just watching TV from down here, Simon, which you won't know much about apparently.
Not yet.
You will. It's tagged onto like adverts, isn't it, for like solicitors, like no win, no fee.
Yeah.
Like it's proper buzzwordy stuff.
But the one thing you'll have never seen an advert for is a solicitor seeking clients for occupational stress work.
Oh God, no.
And there's a reason for that.
Right.
A very small percentage of them win. Probably of all the inquiries I see, 80% of them I could weed out instantly. And of the other 20%, probably only 10% of them are sustainable claims. That's an awful lot of work to figure out which claims are sustainable and which are not. Whereas in a road traffic collision, if somebody's gone into the back of you, you know instantly it's their fault.
Yeah.
And so this has no problem in determining whether or not liability attaches to that.
You got like weed through a lot of nonsense then to get like legit cases.
Yeah, there is a sift. I mean, I created a questionnaire that is my IP, you might say, which performs that sift. But the other people who tend to specialise in this, because the solicitors who do this work typically do specialise, they have that skill set that they know exactly which cases to decline immediately and which to have a conversation about.
it's quite a specialised area, isn't it? So tell us, what is an occupational stress claim? What is it that you're doing then?
Typically, it is a species of employer's liability or a species of occupational disease where the person has suffered a psychiatric injury as opposed to a physical injury. And the ordinary principles of employer's liability apply just as much to a psychiatric injury as they do to a physical. It's just that people typically don't really understand the dynamics of a psychiatric injury claim or an occupational stress claim because they have a story, whereas most other injury claims tend not to have much of a backstory. Person falls off ladder, lands on head, is all very predictable. There may be something of a story as to why they were up a ladder without a harness in the first place, but really, it tends to be in a very abbreviated time frame, the time it took them to fall from the ladder and hit the ground.
Yes.
Whereas occupational stress cases have narratives that can go on for years.
And where employers might come across this then, so when we get sick notes or an employee's off with stress, or the sick note says off with work-related stress, would we say that's the first sort of first red flag, or should we be spotting red flags before that, do you think?
Well, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. It is certainly a red flag in legal terms. Mm-hmm. You have a duty to act the moment you see such a sick note. But the question really is whether the employer has any sort of duty before seeing such information. And that is very much fact specific. It depends on the individual. It depends on the circumstances of the work. So if you know, for example, that somebody is doing the work of two people and are displaying all the signs of deteriorating to illness, reporting to you that perhaps they're not sleeping, that they're ruminating too much about work, they're working evenings, they're working weekends, they're not taking, you've got it, they're
Burnout
not taking the holidays, and they break down in tears in front of you in a staff meeting. You might, in that situation, think to yourself, perhaps we should do something about this. But the truth is, we've all got different psychologies. So going back to my analogy, my example of a person falling off a ladder, we all understand and appreciate the effect of gravity. Person goes up ladder, falls, bangs head, very predictable. Newton told us about it mathematically. But we've all got different psychologies and we all respond differently to stress. And if I give you this little anecdote, lockdown 2020, week one, you might remember the world stopped and we all felt different that week. For me, the end of the week, I was in tears. And the reason I was crying was because I couldn't function without stress. All the stress of my daily existence had been lifted and I was struggling because I've had 25 years of stress loaded on me and that is how I function.
That's so a very strange reaction, that.
It is.
That's very strange.
But some people, my point is that some people thrive on stress.
Yeah.
And they need it to function, don't
you
they?
You need it to function in the way that people need coffee.
Mm.
And some people don't. And we all have unique psychologies. And we all are more vulnerable or less vulnerable at certain times in our lives.
Mm.
My dog died, my last dog died 5-6 years ago. That was a vulnerable moment for me.
Oh, heck yeah.
You know? And we all have those vulnerable moments in our lives where something happens and our capacity to deal with everything else in life perhaps is diminished.
I think when we look at this from an employer's perspective, so we take the ladder, we can put the non-slip step on it, we can put the harness on it, we can take all this preventative action. If we roll out a one-size-fits-all well-being initiative, going, well, there we go, box ticked, we've done what we can to prevent, from what you've just said with the individual psychologies and how people deal with everything differently, some people need stress, some people don't, that one-size-fits-all is never going to work, is it?
It does not absolve you of liability. However, it does help you find those people who, shall we say, are the candidates for support. And that's really where it's helpful.
But I think as well, HR managers, employers, they've got to be more aware. They need to know their workforce better. They need to understand who's working for them, the individual personalities. It's no longer just enough to sit and be the line manager who delegates and issues instructions and, well, you'll do as I say and that's it. You know, we've got to get to know people better.
Completely, which is where things such as exit interviews, anonymous well-being surveys are useful because you understand generally the health, the mental health perhaps, of the labour force. How many people may be leaving your organisation because of some mental health difficulty which was avoidable, perhaps conflict with a bully who was perhaps so terrifying the person didn't raise a grievance, they don't mention it, they find the easiest course, the less stressful course is simply to leave, and you don't find out about that. The bully remains, your talent leaves, and yet it's avoidable.
Yeah. You mentioned there, like, people, the different reactions to stress and how people have different capacities for it. Have you got, like, a metric for that? You mentioned earlier as well, you had, like, a questionnaire thing, which was, like, your IP. Have you got a way of identifying certain levels of stress in people, or is it an experience thing down years?
No, it really does go back to the individual psychology.
I imagine you've got to find stuff out pertaining to the individual. Like, you have to sit down with them one-on-one and spend time.
I would give this simple piece of advice to any manager. When you're conducting a one-to-one, have a stock question on there. How's your mental health? Just show that you care. Ask, you know, how's your physical health? How's your mental health? How's your mental health at work? Just ask.
A lot of things like that.
Yeah. Right, it shows you care, but it also gives you the intel, doesn't it?
Mm. Assuming people are going to be honest.
Yeah, but when it comes to mental health, people are increasingly honest. I think one of the, I suppose, transitions I've seen, and I think the young royals have really led in this area, mm-hmm. is people are increasingly willing to talk about their mental health. And it's not just the young royals. Look at your Tyson Fury, for example, you know, a heavyweight champion of the world, willing to talk about mental health. And by doing that, we destigmatize it. And by destigmatizing it, we actually become healthier. There is what I call the vulnerability paradox at play here, by which I mean people who pretend that they are invulnerable are actually the most vulnerable. Yeah. And those of us that recognize our own vulnerability and realize that there, but for the grace of God, go I, tend to be the healthier, because we accept that mental health, rather like physical health, is something that we can't take for granted and shouldn't.
No. There was something I read on LinkedIn, and it really wound me up. And it was someone who was saying, we shouldn't be promoting resilience, because resilience is just hanging on until basically you collapse. And I thought, you've fundamentally misunderstood resilience. That is not what resilience is about. Mm. And it's about that recognizing where your limits are, processing it, how we deal with it, you know, reflecting on experiences, feeling those emotions, and then working past them, not just ignoring it, suppressing it until, you know, you internally implode. And I'm desperate to find the post again, because I want to red pen it and repost it with my own sort of
That's
thoughts.
Name
on
and
it.
Shame.
Resilience isn't about being bulletproof.
Yeah.
It's about absorbing that negative energy and coming back.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just from what you said then about having that, you know, people who just go and go and go and go until they actually find their limits. Well, no, it's not healthy. We've got to have those, the ability to put the brakes on, to be able to absorb, to have these conversations. And like you were saying, you know, Tyson Fury, footballers, we're seeing it increasingly. People are prepared to talk about it. Mm. And I think from an employer perspective, so with my practice, when I'm dealing with employers, nothing works me up more than when I get someone who comes to me and says, oh, we've got this problem with an employee, we've got this grievance. Mm. And I go, okay, right, give me the history of what's been going on. And I see we've got 9 months of sick notes saying stress at work, and I haven't been informed. They tell me at the point the grievance comes in, when the reality is a year ago, we should have been involved. A year ago, before that first sick note came in, there would have been signs and symptoms and things going wrong. But no, it's only at that pinch point that they're getting in touch with an advisor. And it's not the way to use legal services. You know, by the time it lands on your desk, things have gone very, very wrong indeed. But I think we've got to be more proactive, and that we are calling on those advice points. We are recognizing, you know, where the risk is, before it gets to the point where we've got a grievance, because at that point, really, it's too late.
Sometimes it beggars belief that people don't ask the very simple question when they receive a sick note that says stress at work. What is the source of your stress? What's stressing you? It's a really simple question.
And often employers, they go on the defensive.
Yeah.
It's what they see is they go, oh, we think we might have some legal risk here. It's how can we mitigate it for the business? Whereas actually, by going on a well-being or employee-focused approach to say, how can we help you first, rather than how on earth do we make sure that this isn't our fault, we're probably more likely to get more valuable information about that individual, and we're probably going to make a difference to somebody's life as well, rather than making them go through a formal process that perhaps they don't really want to.
I can segue from that into what I would call my most valuable learning from all the years of litigating occupational stress. If I could give one piece of advice to any HR professional or any employer, it's this, that you can avoid, in probably 9 out of 10 cases, you can avoid liability by asking one question with 5 words. How can I support you? And if you ask that one question, then the chances are you will find the way to avoid ever being embroiled in litigation with somebody who has suffered psychiatric injury in the workplace as a result of either the conditions of their employment or how they've been treated or conflict or whatever other cause they may be.
And what would you say in the situation? So it's something we talk about in the office quite a lot, the differences between the generations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So there isn't a huge amount of years between yourself and I.
6 or 7.
There's a massive generational gap between myself and Dawn, which comes out, you know, in terms of her television choices and fashion choices. But we talk about the woke generation and we talk about, you know, the snowflakes and Gen Z and how difficult they are to employ. And we've done a podcast before and actually how we think they've got a bit of a bad rap. There's a lot that they can teach us about work-life boundaries. You know, you try and give someone of a certain generation work to do over a weekend, they'll tell you what to do with it. Mm. You know, they're very, very good at kind of preserving and looking after themselves. So in terms of then how this affects, you know, when you talk about, you know, risk and all the good stuff that we've just touched on, what's your view then on the next generation and where you see the future of occupational stress with that generation of workforce?
I think you've got two questions rolled in there. Firstly, what do I think of them? I think you're absolutely right. They get a bad rap. But my experience of them is actually that they are pretty plucky, resourceful, brilliant people. I mean, my daughter is age 20, just going off to university, and I see her and her peer group. And frankly, I think they're remarkable and impressive. I think they're starchy, and they're a lot squarer than I was when that age. I mean, frankly, when I was that age, I was a party animal. I mean, you'd hardly believe
it.
Yeah,
they don't drink anymore, do you?
I know.
I'd never put you as that.
I actually worry that they don't know how to enjoy themselves properly. Yeah. I think punk rock couldn't happen today. I just don't think think they'd know what to do. Yeah. I feel as though this is a generation that isn't rebellious enough. Mm. So that's probably...
Yeah.
And also... when it comes to intergenerational, what you might call conflict, or I mean, our generation, I'm sure, was offensive to the generation that came before it and the generation before. That's what we're supposed to be.
It's normal, ain't it?
It is normal.
Yeah, yeah.
It is healthy.
Yeah.
I respect that. I'd be more disturbed by somebody of that generation able to hold a conversation with me in a pub on a Friday night with my dog under the table and a newspaper in front of me. Right. I'd like to think that there is something we simply, or there are some boundaries we simply can't cross intergenerationally. For example, whatever reality TV program you and I were talking about, Ollie, and I had to blank and admit that I had no idea what we were talking about
some
before we came
we
on.
Can't cross, mate. So, some bridges we can't cross.
That's kind of the first part of the question. But the second really about... what do I think their future is in terms of occupational stress? I think it is far better than my generation. So my clients, it won't surprise you to learn, are largely in their mid to late years. I see very few young people, apart from usually young females who've been very seriously sexually harassed or assaulted. That tends to be the greatest hazard for younger people, is having to deal with interpersonal conflict. But actually, when it comes to what you might call burnout or the other causes of occupational stress, what I typically find is young people are better at managing this. And by the time they reach my age, I hope that employers have got wise at how to manage this. So in exactly the same way that if you were to go into the NHS in the 1970s, nurses were regarded as almost dispensable or disposable. You know, they picked up manual handling injuries, had bad backs, and were pensioned or retired out of the job in their 30s or 40s from all that heavy lifting. Now, they can't lift a patient without using some form of manual handling tool. And that is as a result, partly of wisdom, you might say, in the labour force, why lose talent when you can retain it by simply looking after your talent. But also, there were lawyers at the door. There were lawyers willing to litigate those cases, those manual handling operation cases, and represent those nurses through their unions who had suffered life-changing back injuries. And I'd like to think through the work of me and many like me that in perhaps the next 20, 25 years, employers will look at the risk of psychiatric harm and treat it with the same respect and dignity you would the risk of physical injury. So going back to our person going up a ladder, perhaps employers think, am I, in metaphorical terms, sending this person up a ladder from which they will fall and suffer psychiatric injury? And perhaps just show that greater degree of care. Mm. I hope.
Yeah.
My dad's view is a different one. My dad's view is that the world has changed. You go on a bus, there are no conductors. You have a bus driver, he sits behind a Perspex screen.
What's a bus conductor, Simon?
Exactly.
You don't know what a bus conductor is.
This happens a few times. Let's not pretend that doesn't normally happen. I don't know something.
So believe it or not, go on. Buses used to be crewed by two people.
Right.
One who drove the bus.
Right.
The other who collected the fares and made sure everybody on bus was the bus was
train
safe.
Conductor, but on a bus.
You've got it.
Yeah.
There we
go.
Right. I know what that is.
To save money,
they give the job of collecting the fares to the driver who sits at the front. Except the driver cops for all the abuse and now has to sit behind a Perspex screen and all the rest, because not only does the driver drive the bus, but has to manage the bus, manage the customers, manage the fares, and you're effectively giving one person two jobs.
They didn't get paid many more today.
Exactly. And that's my dad's point. My dad's point is that is what is happening throughout work, that actually we're expecting more for less from people in...
And that's adding to stress levels.
You've got it.
There we go. I'm doing the maths.
There is a train of thought that says, you know, with the advent of AI, that actually we are going to see more stress claims because of that very point. So where we've taken away physical assistance, but then where you've got AI that's saying, right, actually now you can do seven jobs because we're taking all of this away, that actually we are going to continue to make that situation worse, that it's not going to make the work-life balance any easier or work-life any easier.
Yeah.
That we are going to continue to push people to amalgamate more and more and more because we're putting reliance now on AI and intelligent computing rather than just individuals.
Maybe. Although I can think of one or two examples in my own work where AI has streamlined a task that I used to find laborious. So I submitted something, a case that I did. I won a case recently. The judgment was published and customers we publicise are successes. I give this to my clerk.
Case study, innit?
Yeah. I hate doing it. I have to sit down and precis a 40-page judgment into 500 or fewer words. It's a pain in the backside. I put it off, usually weeks, if not months later. On this occasion, the judgment was published that day. I dropped it into AI and we had it published up on the internet with a really good summary. And of course, I know it's a good summary because it was my case. I know that it's not hallucinating.
You just paste it in and say, condense this to 500 based on...
You've got
it. It's crazy.
It is. And so that's a really good example of where it's turned a task that would have been hanging over my head and one that I might not have found stressful, but just tedious. And I'm finding it's really good for tedious tasks, but it can't yet replace me.
No. When I first started using it, I say to people, I look at it as like a little assistant.
Yeah.
You get it to do, like you say, things that like admin jobs you can't be bothered to do, really, simple stuff. But
it's a good sidekick.
That's it, though, in my opinion. Like, we've spoke about can't do, and it can't, it's not very intuitive in terms of, employment law legislation, is it, by any means? It gets loads of stuff wrong.
It makes things up. It's that it likes to please, I found as well, which is, it's lovely, it's very endearing, but at the same time, we're like, no, you're wrong. So, anyway, should we hit the questions?
We've got a few, haven't we?
We've had some really good tangents there, actually, and we're going to end up just chatting our way through the entire thing.
How common is it for stress-related leave to escalate into legal action or tribunal claims, and what triggers that escalation?
So, first part of that question, I don't know, because I only see the catastrophes.
Mm. Okay.
I don't see the successes.
The fire's up and you're putting it out.
I'm not even putting it out. I'm the forensic team going.
Oh, you're after the fire.
I'm drawing a line around the bodies. You know.
Yeah.
No, I mean it is a disaster by the time that I'm involved. So I can't tell you of the successes, but I can tell you really, I suppose, where things go wrong. And it's typically a failure to undertake a stress risk assessment, and it's a failure to ask that simple question that I mentioned earlier, how can I support you? There we are. That's where...
Simple as it is.
Simple as that. I can also tell you where employers go wrong when faced with that sick note that says stress at work, or the employer who is saying, no, I'm struggling. And it is to tut and roll their eyes. You get that sick note and tut and roll your eyes, and we're going to meet.
If you hear about an employer doing that, do you kind of like start rubbing your hands a little
bit?
No, because
there's always a tragedy behind it. There's always a human tragedy. One of the reasons I got into occupational stress is because I appreciated that these were serious injuries, that quite often they are career-ending, and that means they're very valuable. You know, I've had employers' liability cases where perhaps people have suffered a really serious injury at work, lost a limb, you know, had an amputation, you know, lost an arm, lost a leg below the knee, and been back at work in a matter of months, doing the same job.
I don't know about that from a risk point of view.
Well, if you're a window cleaner and you've lost a leg, then, you know, perhaps more of a cherry picker than a ladder. But it depends, because often employers can accommodate somebody in another role.
We'll take eldest stepson, surfer, now Paralympic surfer.
Yeah. Reasonable adjustments is the term, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
There we go. This is what I learned from these podcasts.
But my point is, psychiatric injuries can be a lot more profound and life-changing. Because what I typically hear people tell me is, and it doesn't matter whatever diagnostic label you put on the injury, people will say, I've lost my confidence. Now you try sitting here, let's conduct that thought experiment. Try sitting here and doing what we're doing without that intangible sense of confidence that we possess to be able to do it.
I think I won't be very good at this.
I think you wouldn't turn up.
Probably not now.
And that's how serious, you know, occupational stress can be. It can have that devastating impact on people.
And I think because you can't see it, I think employers have less patience, invariably, when they deal with this incorrectly or insensitively. It is that whole, oh, well, just pull yourself together.
And also perhaps a sense that somebody's swinging the lead. Because we all have unique psychologies, and because we can't look inside somebody's head and see how they really are. But the truth is, usually there will be outward signs that the person wasn't coping, and perhaps you haven't been sensitive to them, or you have and you don't have the patience for them.
You notice it, don't you? Especially with people that you work with for a while. You notice changes in behaviour with anyone.
Getting to know your workforce, isn't it? Not having that, being so removed from them. And I think that's where remote working has seen its challenges as well, is because it is harder to get to know somebody through a screen.
Yeah.
And that if you're a line manager and you are managing remotely, you've got to put the hours in, you've got to put the work in to get to know your staff.
Yeah.
Once a week on a Zoom call where, you know, you might have cameras off, where you have a quick chat and go, everything all right? Yep, fine. You're not going to notice if someone doesn't quite look themselves, if perhaps their appearance has started to change, they're not looking after themselves, or miss those little, you know, the body language cues and things like that. There's a lot to it. And it's a big responsibility for line management. You know, people think about, yes, I've been promoted at work and I'm finally a people manager. But rarely, I think, do they think of what that means in terms of impact then for the rest of the team and picking up on those red flags that we've talked about.
I don't think anybody is properly trained in how to manage occupational stress. I just don't think it's in anybody's toolbox. It doesn't matter how good the policy is. It doesn't matter really how good a person's training in that policy may be. The truth is, until you've experienced of managing that individual successfully, you don't know what you're doing. Which is why I give that sterling piece of advice that if you really want to know what you're doing as a manager, ask that simple question, how can I support you?
Tells you a lot about someone, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah.
If they give you an answer anyway, a straight answer.
Yeah.
You learn a lot.
You know, going back to common themes, what I hear time and time again from clients, apart from the I've lost my confidence, is I was unsupported. And often I'll simply ask the individual, what would support look like? And they'll tell me. And that then forms the basis of a particular...
Imagine you hear 101 different things as well, don't you?
Yeah.
You ask that question.
Yeah. But it's remarkable what simple changes people would say. You know, well, I was doing the job of two people. When I left, they recruited two people to backfill me. Mm. Why couldn't they have just recruited another person when I was there and showed they cared?
Mm.
Mm, well,
it's too little too late now at that point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it weren't me, but it was my mate. It was something. He went off work for like a mental health thing.
Yeah.
And like when, I don't know about you, when your mental health's low, well, this is science anyway. I don't know why I'm saying I don't know about you. But like you go out in the sun, don't you? You get a bit of sun on your skin, you go for walks in woods or whatever. Well, I do anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
It's terribly enlightening and stuff. You stop thinking about all the nonsense in your head.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on that? Or where does the law stand on that? Is that okay?
The law doesn't take a view. So I tell you what I love about this question. What I love about it is I can give you two good examples. Two specific clients. One, a police officer was off work with a stress-related illness. Her colleagues saw her on a beach in Thailand.
Okay.
She was posting photographs on Instagram of her holiday with her boyfriend. This then, through some internal leak in the organization, found its way into the national press. Officer off with stress on beach in Thailand. Now, she was taking her annual holiday leave.
That wasn't even...
She was taking her... She may have been off with stress, but whilst off with stress, she was entitled to a paid holiday leave, and she was on holiday leave.
She was on annual leave at the time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I don't know about you, but if I'd been suffering stress at work, a beach in Thailand is exactly the place I would like to be.
Bloody great, doesn't it, really?
It does. So, as you might imagine... Her recovery was on a good trajectory at that point.
Yeah.
Until she saw the Daily Mail.
Until she saw pictures of herself half naked. It's funny you should mention it. It was the sidebar of shame in the Daily Mail.
Oh,
because
no.
That organisation had chosen to leak that story to the national press. Disgraceful.
Yeah.
So, as you can imagine, that didn't have a beneficial effect on her mental health, did it?
I can't imagine she lasted long in the job after that.
No, well, she didn't, and she became a client.
Okay.
Moral of the story is, when somebody's off and you see the photographs on Facebook or Instagram or whatever of them having a good holiday, be pleased that they're having a good holiday, because that hopefully means that they're recovering and they're going to be back at work soon.
Yeah.
Don't criticise somebody for taking a holiday for the benefit of their mental health.
Yeah, unfortunately, a lot of people are bitter about that sort of stuff.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
When I'm managing these situations with clients, the first thing I'll often say is, why is everybody looking at her Instagram? Why is everybody stalking this person's social media whilst they're off on sick leave? Leave
they
the
know.
Person alone, for starters.
Yeah,
it's whatever's going on with them. One, they shouldn't know what they're off sick with generally.
Yeah.
How on earth does the rest of the workforce know this person's off with anxiety, depression, whatever else? And two, what are they all doing stalking social media? And three, why are they all discussing it in the workplace?
Yes.
This is not appropriate.
Yeah.
And when, so I get HR and they're all riled up, or line managers saying, you know, this is ridiculous, this person's in Benidorm. Nine times out of 10, when I've had these situations, the GP has often said to them, do you know what, a break could do you some good.
Which leads me neatly into my next example.
Off you go, Simon.
of a case of a school teacher. I think I'm okay to say she was a school teacher in Bradford. She too had not enjoyed good mental health. She'd been off work. And it was known that she was attending a community centre. The council, using the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act 2000, put her under directed surveillance. In other words, they followed her. They had her followed in exactly the same way that police might undertake surveillance. Now, this is an act of Parliament designed to regulate how public authorities engage in acts of surveillance. They authorised it, and that was high authorisation. They spent the resources to find out whether or not she was engaging in some sort of behaviour that was inconsistent with her sick leave. Anyway, when we ended up in the employment tribunal, and I was cross-examining the person who'd authorised this, as you might imagine, my first question in cross-examination was along the lines of, well, what exactly did you expect to determine was going on in her head by watching her?
It's quite an inappropriate way to investigate, really,
isn't
it?
Not only was it an inappropriate way to investigate, but we got three claims out of that for the price of one.
I can't imagine.
So we had an unfair dismissal claim because they terminated her employment based on her surveillance. Now, the reason that succeeded is because they failed to ask her the very simple question of, well, why were you in a community centre when we were following you? And the answer was, because my GP told me that the best thing for my mental health was to carry going on about my daily routine as much as possible, not to isolate myself and to engage with my friends. And so I engaged outside of the workplace in the community activities that I've always done before. She was religious, and she was involved, as I say, not only with her religious establishment, but the larger community. And she thought that was beneficial for her mental health. Mm. So we won that claim. We then had an occupational stress case because Kel Surprise, when she found out she was under directed surveillance, she really did have a breakdown.
Mm. As most of us probably would.
I've been followed for how long? And of course, she doesn't know at that point. Well, she doesn't know who it is or what the surveillance was, how long it's been going on, the extent. I mean, there were lenses involved. There were camera lenses involved.
If someone's taking pictures of you outside your house and wherever you are, I'd be quite alarmed.
It's invasive.
It is invasive, which is why you need an act of parliament. Which is why you need an act of parliament to regulate it. Mm. So the claim two, as you might imagine, succeeded. And we then had claim three, which is, of course, a breach of her human rights, because it was an absolute violation of her Article 10 rights to put her under directed surveillance for something that was never going to achieve what the employer thought it might. And that's a really good example of what not to do.
Yeah. Don't have someone followed.
Don't have somebody followed.
I think employers do have quite an old-fashioned view of what it looks like when someone's on sick leave, that they should be buried under their duvet, you know, with a cup of chicken soup and watching television and do not leave the house. That's not how we recover from illnesses and conditions.
If your employee is hill-walking in Scotland whilst off with occupational stress, that is good.
Yeah.
That is good.
Yeah. And I think it's that conversation about what's inconsistent with a sick note. And the example I always give, if someone says that they're off with, you know, I don't know, arthritis in their knees and they're photographed on a climbing holiday.
Completely inconsistent.
Inconsistent with the sick note. Yeah. If someone is sat on a beach and they're off with anxiety and depression, well, you know what? It's probably what the doctor ordered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Therefore, not
take a holiday.
Yeah.
You're burnt out. You need a holiday.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of burning out, I think we're out of time.
We have
chatted.
We've burnt the candle. We have.
We have. This has been a really, really good session.
Well,
I think.
Thank you for inviting me.
What's one myth about stress leave that you'd love to bust right now?
I think I've already covered it. I think the myth is that the law treats psychiatric injury any different to physical injury. It really doesn't. It really doesn't. As long as the injury is foreseeable, it doesn't matter. There's a really good case that illustrates that called Page and Smith, and I'm not going to descend into law, but I'll tell you a little bit about the facts of that case because I think it illustrates the point. The claimant, Mrs. Page, in that particular case, was in a road traffic accident where she suffered no physical injury, none at all. But she suffered a terrible deterioration in her chronic fatigue syndrome, in her ME, which, as many would agree, has a psychiatric component. And so it had physical symptoms, but what might be termed a psychiatric trigger. And the House of Lords had to consider the question of whether or not in a situation where a physical injury was foreseeable, but a psychiatric injury manifested, whether the motorist or the insurer was liable. And the House of Lords is very clear in saying, you don't have to foresee the type of injury that will result. All you need to foresee is that injury will occur. In other words, physical injury, psychiatric injury, they're injury. They are not distinguishable just because one happens to be said to be of the mind and the other of the body. Because that dualistic model that thinks that the mind and the body are separate is wrong. We are unitary organisms with a psychology. We are both body and mind. We are not body and mind.
No, I agree. I agree. You break your leg, mate. Your brain's going to panic.
You break your leg and you're a long distance runner and you are going to suffer some serious psychological harm.
Tell me about it.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there, mate, I think.
Great. And then I think final one, if we were going to have another guest on the show, who would you recommend?
I've thought about this and my pal Chelsea Brooke Ward. Mm-hmm. partly because she's got absolutely killer heels. I don't know how she walks in them. There's going to be payback when she's my age. I don't think anybody can wear heels like that without payback one day. Chelsea rocks. Mm-hmm. But I think really, she's really hot on remedies. Mm-hmm. So remedies, not just in the important tribe, but she's written text on remedies. And I think she's probably your person to speak to.
Thanks for your time, Simon. Thanks for your time, Alyssa, as ever. Like, comment, subscribe. Cheers.
Until next time, we're your hosts signing off from HRER. Take care of your HR and may your workplace be disaster-free. Before we go, a big thank you to you for tuning in and don't forget to subscribe. If you have your own ER stories or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us at Heroes or on social media or even HRER@heroes.co.uk. As we navigate the maze of workplace blunders, remember that no organisation is perfect. But by sharing these stories, we can all work towards creating healthier, happier and more productive workplaces.